This is the Afternoon Magazine on WILL AM 580. Good afternoon, I'm Celeste Quinn. Wondering what to have for dinner this evening? How about something Italian, a hearty soup or pasta to warm you and the kitchen? Well, if it sounds good, stay tuned. Our guests today are cooks, food writers, and cookbook authors. They are John and Galina Mariani. Together, they are the authors of the Italian-American Cookbook, a feast of food from a great American cooking tradition. Their book covers everything from appetizers, antipasti, to desserts and confections. In between, soups, salads, seafood, meat and poultry, pizza, and pasta. In addition to recipes, you'll find history and entertaining anecdotes from the authors' lives. Listeners, I encourage your questions and comments for our guests. Join us with a telephone call. In Champaign-Urbana, our number, 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Anywhere else, call toll-free 1-800-222-9455. 800-222-9455. WILL. Let me tell you more about our guests. John Mariani is the author of The Dictionary of Italian Food and Drink and the Encyclopedia of American Food and Drink. He's also a columnist for Esquire, Spectator, and Diversion magazines. Galina Mariani is a cooking teacher, a food columnist for Millionaire Magazine, and a former television spokeswoman for Cooking Light magazine. Their book, The Italian-American Cookbook, is published by Harvard Common Press. In Champaign-Urbana, 333-WILL. Anywhere else, toll-free, 800-222-WILL. John and Galina, good afternoon. Welcome.
Thank you.
Thank you.
How are you?
We're great.
Good. Well, tell us...
Sunny day. You have a beautiful snow from coating Tuckahoe, New York, where we live outside of New York.
Yeah. Here it is. We're having a little bit of a warm-up, a day-long January thaw, I guess. Mm-hmm. We're at 36 degrees. Well, let's begin with your passion for cooking. How did it begin? John, when did you begin cooking?
Well, curiously enough, I grew up in an Italian family, and Galina grew up in a Russian and French family. And we met at, she was at college and I was at graduate school. I was at Columbia and she was at Manhattanville. And I met her on a night when, and I can't imagine why I was doing this, but I offered to cook a chocolate souffle for another girl at Manhattanville. And Galina came walking in and our kind of eyes met, and it went on from there. And we pretty soon found out afterwards that both of us really liked to cook and enjoyed food with the little money we had, so that early on in our relationship, we made a lot of third-world cuisine.
Yeah. We also came, I think both of us came from families that where food was quite important. Families gathered around the table, and John's family was Italian, mine was French and Russian, and we just came from families that loved to cook and cooked well, and it just genetically... just followed through.
Yeah. Galina, what foods did you grow up with at home?
At home, basically French and Russian food. But then later on in life, I met John at a very early age, so the two of us ate a lot in Italian restaurants, and we have a lot of Italian friends, a lot of homes we went to. So I was constantly being exposed to Italian food, not only in homes, but obviously in New York, where Italian food is so predominant. It was around all the time.
Yeah,
I was fascinated when I would go over to Galina's family's house, and we might very well, on a summer's night, have a good American sirloin steak. Oh, I just as well have these little Russian hamburgers, which are called kepliete, which have dill in them and onion and so forth. Or we might have these pilmeni, which are basically Russian ravioli. And so, you know, the food cultures crisscross so much, whereas that Russian ravioli would be made in a chicken broth and sour cream. In Italy, they would be made with a chicken broth and parmigiano.
Hmm. And John, in your house, in your family history, your paternal grandmother, if I have this correct, immigrated to this country from Italy. And for your mother to pass muster with her, she had to be a good cook and know how to cook Italian.
It was absolutely crucial, and I suspect for many years, a couple of centuries in the United States, that was probably true of prospective brides, too. But there was no question that if my mother could not cook the Abruzzese from the Abruzzo section of Italy, those dishes for my father, I don't think she would have been able to marry my father.
Well, didn't her actually her mother-in-law to be quizzed her at that?
Yeah, absolutely.
She had to pass a test.
Whew. My palms are sweaty now just thinking about that. The first large wave of Italian immigration, late 19th century?
Yeah, from 1880 till about 1910, 1950, up to World War I, when, of course, immigration was stopped cold.
And over this period of time, from that first wave of Italian immigrants to today, has Italian-American cooking changed much?
Well, that's really the whole point of this book. There are already published some wonderful Italian-American reminiscences, cookbooks, my mother's cooking, my aunt's cooking, the cooking of this Brooklyn neighborhood and that Bronx neighborhood and so forth. And they're very good books. When Harvard Common Press asked Galena and I to do this book, I said I really wasn't interested in that. They said, no, we want 100 years of Italian-American cooking, which has changed in an evolutionary sense from a very basic cuisine, cooking of very, very poor Italian immigrants to become not only the favorite ethnic food of Americans, but also to become extremely refined at this point, to the point where if you go to Paris or if you go to Berlin or if you go to Tokyo, you're much more likely to see Italian-American-style food there than you are Italian food in those restaurants.
Interesting. What are some of the great classic Italian-American dishes?
Well, we all know spaghetti and meatballs, and while meatballs called polpette are known in Naples, they're very, very small. And this is really the story of the immigrant cooking, that my forebears, my ancestors, who are very, very poor, would be spending up to 75 to 85% of their meager income on just keeping themselves fed. When they got to New York, Ellis Island, which 90% of them passed through of the more than 10 million Italians that came here, when they got here, they found that they could have meat three or four times a week. They were spending only 25% of an increased income when they got a job and came here. So this was, talk about the promised land. They weren't looking for streets of gold. They were looking for streets of bread and meat. And so the meatball became larger and more predominant. And the pizza became, which comes from Naples, the pizzas went from small discs to big, huge, large wheels. So that a lot of people claim that pizza was invented in America, which is not true. But Italians outside of Naples until well after World War II would never have laid eyes on a pizza in Italy.
I wonder if our immigrant experience is the reason our portions in this country are so large, because in my family, one of my grandmothers came from Ireland, the west of Ireland, and it was sort of the same situation. Mm-hmm. They came here looking, to survive and to prosper. And always growing up, my grandmother put much more food on our plates than we could almost possibly eat.
It's a very maternal instinct, obviously, especially when you don't know when your next meal is coming from. And it's interesting, in the Irish experience, the potato came from America. The tomato came from America. The chili peppers came from America. All of these cultures, which we think, especially Italian culture with its tomato sauce, Italians didn't even have any tomatoes until the 17th century. So when the poor Irish, were forced to live on these root vegetables while the better vegetables were being sold at the market, the potato was considered the poor people's food that no one would touch except for the Irish and the Germans and the Poles and the Italians. In order to get enough nutrients from this wonderful, wonderful vegetable, you have to eat an enormous amount of them. And so when the Irish potato famine occurred in 1845, sending your ancestors to America, it was because they had nothing to eat at all and couldn't survive on one or two potatoes a day. So that abundance you talk about, those big, huge portions with mashed potatoes, maybe two or three different potatoes. It's very interesting, even to this day when you go to Ireland, you'll find two or three potato dishes at every meal.
Yeah, well, it wasn't uncommon in our house to have oven-browned potatoes and mashed potatoes.
Mm-hmm. But I think you're probably right. The abundance does come from the fact that they were deprived of food for a long time, and therefore, when they came to this country, it was they had it in abundance, and they gave large portions. But I think that probably yourself, as well as my family and many other families, we were brought up to eat everything on our plate.
Right.
You would never, ever throw anything out, and that stems from the times when they had nothing. They would never think of throwing anything out. You couldn't leave the table until you finished.
See, I remember my Galina telling me about when her brother was a very little boy. He was a very picky eater, and he was not allowed to leave the table until such time as he either finished it or his grandmother used to take the food away and feed it to the dog or put it someplace. That says, yes, Igor has finished. He can now get up from the table.
When the parents weren't looking.
Thank goodness for grandmas.
Yeah. Yes.
Speaking of which, a dear friend of mine, one of her grandmothers, Italian-American, thought that spatulas were the greatest things ever. And she gave my friend Kate, you know, like a set of them so she could get into every nook and cranny of every jar or every pot and pan. So it's really interesting. One of the things that I really enjoy about your book is it seems to me that this is a balance of classics and some ideas that are very new to me, anyway, is coming from an Irish-American background. And there's also a balance of basics and dishes for folks with a little more experience in the kitchen. How did you come to decide, you know, what recipes you were going to include?
Well, we started off by taking the old traditional recipe. We just made a list of them. Veal parmesan, chicken cacciatore, pizza, spaghetti and meatballs, that sort of thing. But you would find a kind of a typical Italian menu either in a restaurant or at home. And then when we got all of those set, and that probably is well over 100, 150 recipes out of the 300 in the book, then we said, well, how did it evolve? And how is it regionally different? For instance, there in the Midwest, in St. Louis, they do something nobody else does in the United States, a wonderful thing called toasted ravioli, which is basically ravioli, which is just put in a little milk bath and then breaded with cornmeal and deep-fried and served with marinara sauce. So we put that in. We put barbecued shrimp from New Orleans and spaghetti bordelaise from New Orleans. We have cioppino from San Francisco. So then we finished with all those very Italian, American dishes that were regionally distinct. And then we looked at those kinds of recipes that have been created on the basis of the enormous variety of new ingredients, good, fine olive oil and balsamic vinegar that have come in since the 1970s, so that now we have recipes in there.
We have like chicken with peppers and balsamic vinegar. Well, balsamic vinegar was not used up until they started bringing it into this country maybe 5-10 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
Or chicken a la jardiniera, which is basically a chicken scallopini dish with a salad on top of it, also, which was not served then. This is kind of an evolution of dishes. And maybe we have also spicy roasted sausage and grapes.
Oh, that's a wonderful dish.
That's a wonderful dish. Yeah, mm-hmm. Caramelized in the oven and then put it with balsamic vinegar. With wonderful taste of the sweet grapes with the spicy roasted sausages.
Yeah. And thinking about the new and the old and the new, if you just look at the chapter on pasta, for example, you've got spaghetti, macaroni and cheese, and lasagna, and then duck ravioli and rock shrimp cannelloni.
Yes.
Yeah, the rock shrimp cannelloni came from a chef, American chef named Brian Whitmer from California in San Francisco. And any dishes that would include funghi porcini or American ingredients, which funghi porcini are not specifically, would be modern, too. Then we have, well, you know, I think every foodie now knows the name Ming Tsai, who was a wonderful Chinese-American chef born in Ohio, who opened up a restaurant outside of Boston and is now a big TV celebrity on the TV Food Network. And we have a photograph of him at an Italian grocery, and a recipe by him which takes oxtail and polenta, which are very Italian, but does it with a kind of soy sauce and a Asian
ginger
Chinese ginger.
Yes.
And that's what we call modern Italian-American food.
Mm-hmm. Ming Tsai hosts a program called East Meets West on
right.
the yes. Cooking Network. Right. So that gives you an idea right there that he is combining flavors from around the world.
Yeah, I mean, you know, something like pasta is just, well, there is a wonderful Italian-American cookbook that we didn't write called, we called it Macaroni by, I think his name is Simonetti. And that was a book which came, is about all of the old traditional southern Italian dishes, I think in Brooklyn or the Bronx somewhere, in which they didn't know the name pasta. But pasta became very, very fashionable in the 1980s, so that now you cannot go to a French restaurant in France, as well as the United States, without seeing a ravioli with foie gras and cannelloni with crab with a bechamel sauce. And the French are cooking with more olive oil than ever before.
Hmm. Is pasta at the heart of Italian cooking?
It is. Largely speaking, it is, because it was inexpensive, and among the poor it could be made with plenty of vegetables. You didn't need meat, and Italians don't sauce their pasta to this day. So that whole spaghetti and meatball abundance thing is just unknown in Italy. So that while you will find more rice dishes and risottos in the north and more polenta in, let's say, Venice, one of the staples certainly is pasta throughout Italy. And dried pasta has been used far, far more than so-called fresh pasta, which became kind of chic in the 1980s.
And I think that every meal always in Italy consists of there's always a pasta course, whether it's lunch or dinner, and they may have a little antipasto to start with, and then they'll have a bowl of pasta, and then maybe a little piece of grilled meat or a little grilled fish, maybe with a little side order of vegetable. But pasta definitely seems like the center of the meal. I mean, they will never have a meal without pasta.
Mm-hmm. I remember once when my son was considerably younger at a soccer at a soccer game.
Oh yes,
and or a football game or something. And one of the Italian fathers yelled out to his son, who had just missed a tackle. He says, "You miss another tackle, you don't get no macaroni tonight." And that's a real threat to an Italian kid.
Well, pasta is so good, you know. And it, there are noodles around the world.
Sure.
You know, and everybody, who doesn't like noodles? Who doesn't like their macaroni?
Well, you know, that's interesting, because at this point, that's absolutely true. But when you think of it, except in the East, in Asia, of course, noodles have long been a part of their culture. And the Germans and some of the Poles and others have pasta. But outside of Italy and some Eastern European countries, you really don't find noodles. You don't find it in the north. You don't find it in Scandinavia. You don't find it in England. You don't find it anywhere in France. You don't even find it in Spain, Portugal, or Greece. It's really only become a real, real world-shaking food over in the last 20 years.
Thanks to the Italians and the Asians, I guess.
Yeah,
huh?
Very much
yes.
so.
Yeah.
Although I've got to say right here, and there's documentary evidence right in the book, that no, Marco Polo did not bring back pasta from the East. What he did was to report that they had pasta just like we're eating here in Italy.
What were the early pasta dishes of Italy?
The very earliest ones, and as we know them, would be quite plain, dressed with a little sauce and eaten with the fingers. And back in Roman times, they would bake the noodles very, very often, sometimes right on a hot stone and so forth. And they would sauce them with garum, which was a kind of an anchovy sauce at the time. But again, unless you made them at home, there really wasn't any store-bought pasta available to Italians until really well into the 18th and 19th century. And in World War One, when Italian-Americans couldn't get imported pasta, for the first time somebody thought, hey, maybe we should start making our own pasta. So within 5 or 6 years of World War One, there were 8 pasta production plants in Brooklyn, New York alone.
Interesting. Is there a difference in quality between fresh pasta and dried pasta?
Galina, you want to address that?
It's just basically has a different texture to it. Certain sauces go better with dry pasta. The fresh pasta also tends to absorb more liquid when combined with the sauce. So it's really a question of preference and sauces.
The fresh pasta is better for layered pastas like lasagnas, but hard pastas are much, much better for that al dente quality.
Yes.
And that weedy flavor that you really want. A lot of fresh pastas are made only with egg and egg and flour, whereas a lot of dried pastas are made with water and flour.
My husband is a great guy, and he's really good in the kitchen, and he has made a pasta for lasagna that is wonderful, where he incorporates sage and rosemary in the pasta. And that really works really well. That is so true that fresh pasta works beautifully in lasagna.
Well, to Italians, pasta itself, the noodle, the shape of it, is what's the main ingredient. As I said, they don't sauce their pastas very heavily. You will not ever find a dish of pasta swimming in sauce. There will not be a kind of dilution of the gravy or the sauce underneath it. They'll put a little bit on top, they'll mix it. Then if you want some more sauce, an individual can take some. But they believe that the pasta itself must be of such quality that you get flavor right out of it. So your husband's adding flavor into the pasta, of course, makes the pasta itself even more appealing.
Yes, they don't believe in drowning the pasta flavor. They really do want to taste the quality of the pasta itself.
Yeah. This lasagna that he's making is fairly dry, and then there is sauce on the side that you can put, a tablespoon or however much you'd like.
And that's the way also the pasta sauces should be fresh and they should be intense. And if you've made them with weak, anemic tomatoes, no amount of sauce is going to help. We stress again and again and again in the Italian-American cookbook that if you're not going to buy good ingredients, the best ingredients, extra virgin olive oil and not canned mushrooms and not canned olives, just don't make the dish because it's not going to turn out all that well.
Or certainly also vegetables that are in season. Use, if there's a recipe with a specific vegetable that's not in season, then maybe you should pick another recipe. For instance, there's a papa al pomodoro recipe, which is basically a tomato soup made with bread in it. And I would never, ever think of making it when tomatoes are out of season. That's basically, I make it in August and maybe September, when the tomatoes are full flavored and you can get them from a farm somewhere in the area. But otherwise, it's just not worth it.
And the basil, too.
And the basil as well, yes.
When it's at its peak.
Yes.
Well, in Genoa, where pesto comes from, which is made with basil, they are fanatical about this. And they say that, they get so crazy that they say that only certain parts of Genoa where the sunlight hits the window boxes as the basil grow. But they are insistent that basil is at its peak for a few weeks, and that's when you make the sauce. You don't make it in January. You don't make it in November because the basil is not going to be as good.
Yeah.
It's very reasonable because that's when it is going to be best.
Now, the two of you do recommend canned Italian-style tomatoes, and you use them,
absolutely,
right?
And as a matter of fact, there's certain you have to test, try out different brands, see which ones you prefer. There are some that are much that are more consistent than others, and I have a favorite that I use all the time, which is the Red Pack. Very rich flavor. That's an American tomato.
Whereas if you're using the imported, you should look for San Marzano, which is not a brand name, but it's a region of Italy from which tomatoes come and which they grow best. So look for San Marzano on it. But there's a lot of good brand names, Squisite and Del Verde. But we should, Americans shouldn't be ashamed of their tomatoes because this is where the tomato came from in the first place.
That's right, home of the tomato.
This is the Afternoon Magazine, and we're talking this afternoon about Italian-American cooking. Our guests are cooks, food writers, and cookbook authors. They are the authors of the Italian-American Cookbook, now available from Harvard Common Press. Our guests' names, John Mariani and Galina Mariani. My name is Celeste Quinn. Listeners, I welcome your questions and comments about Italian cooking this afternoon. Join us with a telephone call in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Anywhere else, call toll-free 1-800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. We mentioned just a moment ago sauce and saucing pasta, and Galina, I am looking forward to doing your recipe for meat sauce. And I was wondering if maybe you might talk with us about that, and maybe even, if you wouldn't mind, sharing the recipe.
Certainly. Well, first of all, it's happens to be my own recipe that I've made and tested on family and friends, and everybody always loved it, so I thought this would definitely be the one to include in the book. We start off with olive oil, good olive oil. One does not need to use extra virgin olive oil. Extra virgin olive oil is good for other things, but a good quality olive oil is just fine. And we heat that up, and we chop up three yellow onions, two carrots and celery and six garlic cloves, and put it into the hot oil and put it on medium heat and just cook it until for about 10 minutes to release the flavors and soften them up. Add some salt and pepper. And then in another pan, we brown the beef. I use beef, chopped beef chuck, until it's not, I actually use some of the olive oil. I don't put all the olive oil to brown the vegetables. I keep some of it for the beef. So in a heat a frying pan and put some olive oil and then heat up and then saute the beef chuck until it's nice and brown, and put that in with the vegetables and add some bay leaves, some oregano, a little bit of sugar, and three 28-ounce Italian-style tomatoes. Like, as I had mentioned, the red pack are wonderful. And just crush them up or coarsely chop them.
You know, I might add that, as Galina suggested, tomatoes are not consistent throughout the year, even if they are canned. So if you taste them and, you know, they don't have that much flavor, putting a little bit of sugar is not corrupting it. What happens with a lot of bottled sauces that you find in the United States is that they're sweetened because Americans like a sweet flavor in everything.
Mm-hmm.
But the other thing you could do if you find that the tomatoes are not as intense as you want, even after you have simmered them down, is to add a little tomato paste.
Mm-hmm. We add the tomato paste in this one as well.
Yeah, and that just bulks it up, you know, it just brings it up a little bit more, just as in Burgundy, they add a little sugar to their wine to bring up the alcohol content.
And what kind of pasta would you use with this sauce, Galina?
Actually, you could. I happen to love spaghetti.
Uh-huh.
You could use spaghetti, or you could use penne. And just serve it with that, and then, of course, top it with a wonderful Parmigiano cheese.
Mm.
You know, the pasta, there are over 500, well, depending on who you speak to, there are 500 to 1,000 pasta shapes in Italy, and you say, well, what do they need them all for? And certain shapes do pick up different flavors better than others, and fresh pasta picks up some things better than dry and vice versa. So with a sauce like this, which is chunky and full of meat and vegetables, to have something like one of those big Z ziti, which has a big hole in it, and the ridges on the outside. That's going to pick up a lot of the flavor of this kind of dish. Whereas you probably wouldn't use that kind of pasta for a cream sauce, which is just going to lavish itself over everything. That's why cream sauces and butter sauces are usually used on flat pastas like fettuccine.
Mm. Mm-hmm. You know, going back to the idea of sweetness, I also think this sauce, you'd want to taste it as you go, because your carrots might be fairly sweet, or the carrots vary too.
Yes, they do.
You know, some are not as sweet as others.
Absolutely.
And onions as well.
Absolutely. Yeah.
You know,
find that carrots have more sweetness if you buy them fresh with the green on them.
Mm-hmm.
The fresh carrots, as opposed to the ones that are packaged in a little bag. And those sometimes tend to be not quite sweet. They usually keep them in storage for weeks and even months, and they lose their natural sweetness. But if you buy the carrots with the greenery on it, they tend to be a lot sweeter.
Interesting.
And tastier.
Yeah.
What's interesting about meat sauce in Italy, this is traditionally called sauce bolognese from Bologna. And there, while there's certainly a good portion of meat in it, there's very, very little tomato. And most of the flavor comes from chopped up vegetables. So a true bolognese sauce, which Galina's is not, would be a sauce that's made mostly with vegetables and with some meat and a little bit of potato and probably even a touch of cream, perhaps.
And wine, too. Yes.
Whereas the Italian-American meat sauce, which Galina just spoke of, is really hefty with meat. Again, going back to that abundance theme.
And hefty with a lot of with tomatoes, but that also comes from the Italian immigration being from the southern part, predominantly from the southern part of Italy, where they use more tomatoes than they do in the north.
Mm. This recipe, Galina, how much does it make, do you suppose? It says serves 8 to 10.
Yes, it's a... I made a large portion of this for a reason. I figured it takes some time to make, and whatever is not used, you could freeze very easily and have it in your freezer to use at another time,
yeah.
Any other given time. And as a matter of fact, the sauce does taste better if you make it a day in advance. So all the flavors blend in well, and the following day it tastes wonderful.
Yeah, so you can you double this recipe, I suppose.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and I'm sorry.
It might be commented that very few Italian sauces do take a long time to make. Very, very few. Most of them are extremely fresh and made right on the spot. But this, which is called traditionally a ragu, R-A-G-U, not the bottled stuff, a ragu is a sauce that has been cooked a long time and usually contains meat.
Yeah, but it looks to me that this doesn't take more than an hour and a half from start to finish.
Probably an hour and a half. I suggest about 45-minute cooking time. Some Italians tend to cook their meat sauces for hours on end, and I find that really does not benefit the sauce. 45 minutes is plenty of time, but if you make it, as I said, the day before, that's perfect.
Yeah, I think too much cooking will tend to... take away the brightness of the vegetables and tomatoes. And although we have another recipe or note in there about I was cooking just a simple tomato sauce without meat one day, and I got a phone call and left it on. When I came back, it had reduced so much that it was you know, they're almost like caramel, and it had a burnt flavor, but it was delicious. It really was good. There wasn't much of it, though.
Serendipity.
Yeah.
Yeah. This is the Afternoon Magazine. Our guests this afternoon, Galina and John Mariani, authors of the book, The Italian-American Cookbook, A Feast of Food from a Great American Cooking Tradition. Listeners, I welcome your telephone calls, 333-WILL in Champaign-Urbana, 800-222-WILL anywhere else. Well, I think I know what your answer to this question is going to be, but here goes anyway. What do you think of ready-made sauces available on the market today?
Frankly, I have a very, very low opinion. You know, you really don't find them in Italy, and while I'm not so much an Italophile that I don't think there are good Italian-American products, which there are, but I really haven't found any. I don't know if it's the preservatives, or if you look on the back of these things, the listings, are usually listing the same kind of things you'll find in American boxes of cereals or anything else. There's a lot of sugar. It's usually the second or third ingredient, a lot of salt, a lot of sorbate of this and stearate of that, and I think that all shows up. They're usually too thick and viscous. I haven't found a good one yet that I really like.
Mm. Yes, I agree. And if you make a very simple tomato sauce, and there's the marinara sauce, for instance, that we have in the book, it's very simple. All you do is heat up some olive oil. You put in a few crushed garlic cloves in there. You let it cook for a minute or two. You take them out. You put a large can of Italian tomatoes in, crushed or chopped. A little oregano, salt and pepper. You let it cook for 15, 20 minutes, and it's done.
I have made that sauce literally. My son who's come home from school just starving says, "Dad, is there any pasta sauce?" And while the pasta's cooking, before the water is going to take, 10 minutes to boil, the pasta itself is going to take 6 minutes to cook. So there you've got 16 minutes to make a sauce, and I've done it in exactly that amount of time.
Let's talk with a listener on line one in Terre Haute, Indiana. Good afternoon.
Yeah, talking about taking days to make sauces and that type of stuff. Several years back, we lived in Jersey City. At that time, it was either Italian or Hebrew in that area. Mm-hmm. But anyway, the lady who was the landlord told my wife, she said she'll teach you how to make real Italian spaghetti, with the tomato sauce and all that. And one day she came over and said, "Okay, come on over." And so the lady started opening up cans of sauces and stuff like that, pouring the can. Finally, my wife said, I thought we had to go down the store and buy a special plum, Italian tomatoes and all. She said, "Honey, the stuff in the cans are 10 times better than the stuff my mom or grandmother ever made."
Well, I don't know. If that was an Italian woman, she could be hanged in Italy.
Yeah, I know. But,
by her ankles.
Yeah, I always, think about that, when they talk about, for years, how they had to, cook the stuff. But I'll tell you, this sauce is really good.
Mm-hmm.
But the other thing is there any trick of the trade, like when you was talking about the sweetness of carrots or onions, could you soak those, say, like in sugar water, and it would make them sweeter?
No, there's no really necessity to do that. Onions, just on their own, if you cook them in oil or butter, at a medium heat and start, they start browning on their own, they release their own sugars, and they're very sweet.
Uh-huh.
They really don't need sugar added to it.
Sometimes we just make a whole mess, so we'll take like 10 of these big, huge Spanish onions in a huge, huge skillet and just cook them slowly, slowly. You can do it in the oven, too. Very, very slowly. And they taste like caramel when you're finished.
We were talking about adding a little bit of sugar to tomato sauces sometimes, and one of the other reasons you put a little bit of sugar in, sometimes tomatoes tend to be rather acid.
Yeah.
So to neutralize the acidity in a sauce, you just add a little teaspoon or so into a big batch of tomato sauce, and it'll just balance the acidity.
Yeah. You shouldn't be able to taste it.
No, you shouldn't be able to taste
it. You don't want to say, "Hey, there's sugar in there."
Right.
Always taste as you go, I guess.
There's another little trick of the trade is in many dishes, not in many, but in several dishes in our book, one single anchovy is added, which no one ever, ever tastes, especially those who don't like anchovies, and yet it is an ineffable underpinning, like salt, pepper, or anything else, that adds just measurably to the depth of flavor in a dish.
Mm.
But no one would ever suspect that it's in there.
Yeah. I want to thank the caller for his call this afternoon. Before we run out of time, John, I wanted to ask you, and first of all, I want to ask you if I'm pronouncing this correctly. Gnocchi?
Gnocchi, yes.
Gnocchi. Good.
Gnocchi.
I love this dish.
Oh, it's one of John's favorites.
I was so happy to see recipes for it in the book and so happy to learn that it's not tough to make.
I was amazed at that too, because my mother always said, "You want a gnocchi? Yeah, come on, make a gnocchi." Oh, brother, I got to make a gnocchi. Well, there goes my Sunday. it's not that way at all. Gnocchi can be made in about 20 minutes flat. I mean, basically, well, Galina, you're the recipe maker. Tell her how quickly it, Celeste, how quickly it is to make.
Well, it's you basically it's flour and eggs. Flour. You have to boil Idaho potatoes, dry potatoes, and you boil them. And you peel them and you let them cool off, and you mash them up. And basically, you mix these cooled potatoes, mashed potatoes, with egg and flour and a little heavy cream, salt and pepper, and you form this dough. And then you cut it into pieces, and you roll them out in this little kind of a rope-shaped form, and then you just cut them up. Now, if you want to really perfection them and make those little ridges in the little gnocchi, you take each little piece and you kind of roll it gently. You have to get the knack of it, but it comes fairly quickly. You get roll it either over a fork or the base of a whisk, and you get those little shapes in the gnocchi. But if that's just too much work and you don't want to go through all of that, just cut up little gnocchi are fine. And just boil them and serve them with your favorite sauce.
Yeah.
And boil them very quickly. Don't let these things take, like, but when they rise up and you plop them in the boiling water, and they rise to the top, say one Hail Mary and they're done.
Which is, about two quick paragraphs, right?
That's right.
And when these are good, they are like little pillows.
Yes, they are.
They're so wonderful. Good. What about buying that pasta ready-made? I have my doubts about that.
Well, it's almost always frozen, which is not, there's nothing wrong with freezing a lot of stuff. We use frozen food, certainly. But I think that it kind of, whatever water might be in there, it's going to condense it. And the texture just isn't that, as you said, that light, feathery quality.
It changes the texture, yes. Mm. But they have to freeze it because they're so delicate that they couldn't really, they would be very difficult to sell them fresh.
I have seen them vacuum packed.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know.
Probably in one layer then.
Yeah, and yeah. I guess I'm just going to.
It's very expensive.
Yeah, I guess what I'm going to do is just try your recipe.
Please, tell us how it works out.
And one last thing before we go. One of the best Italian-American food memories I have of growing up, although I'm not Italian-American, the fig cookies my Italian-American friends' mothers and grandmothers would make for special occasions. Fig Newtons I like, but the Italian fig cookies of my childhood, just out of this world. And figs turn up in a number of your recipes, in confections and in main courses. What part of Italy are figs used in regionally for cooking?
Well, at this point, they'd be used all over the country, but originally those are very Mediterranean. Figs probably came from the Middle East, from Greece, from Morocco, from Tunisia, and they worked their way up slowly through Sicily and into the boot of Italy. So from Rome and south of Rome, you'll find a lot of dried fruits, dried raisins, fruit cakes, and so forth. They love those things in the south. And that really is the influence of the food culture of the Middle East.
Wow, interesting. Yeah, of course, figs and dates.
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
Yeah. Well, what's for dinner tonight, you two?
Actually, we're going out to dinner tonight, so we won't be dining. But last night, the kids did ask, almost as my wife was going out the door, hey, can you make chicken parmesan? So Galina made the marinara sauce in about 18 minutes flat, and there it was.
Well, happy cooking and have a great night out tonight.
Well, thank you very much for having us, and I hope those gnocchi turn out just fine. I hope you love them.
Okay.
If you have any problems, give us a call, Celeste.
Okay, take care now.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Galina and John Mariani, they are the authors of the Italian-American Cookbook, A Feast of Food from a Great American Cooking Tradition. This is the Afternoon Magazine on WILL AM 580. You also find us on the World Wide Web at WILL.UIUC.edu. 10 minutes before 2 o'clock Central Time, settlement prices in from the Chicago Board of Trade. Here with the numbers, AM 580's Carrie Moore.
Thank you, Celeste, and good afternoon. March wheat today had a high of 287, the low 283. It settled 285 and three quarters, up 1/2. May, the high 298 and three quarters, the low 295. It settled 296 and three quarters, up 1. July, the high 309 and three quarters, the low 306. It settled at 308 and one quarter, up 1/2. September, the high 319 and one quarter, the low 316 and 1/2. It settled 318 and three quarters, up 1 and one quarter. December wheat, the high 334, the low 330 and 1/2. It settled at 333, up 1 and 1/2. March corn, the high 216, the low 213 and 3 quarters. It settled 214, down 1 and 1 quarter. May, the high 224, the low 222. It settled at 222 and 1 quarter, down 1 and 1 quarter. July, the high 232. The low for July 230, it settled at 230 and 1/2, down 3 quarters. September corn, the high 240, the low 238 and 1 quarter, it settled at 238 and 1/2, down 1/2. December, the high 250 and 3 quarters, the low 248 and 1/2, it settled at 248 and 3 quarters, down 1 and 1 quarter. March oats, the high 259, the low 257 and 1/2, it settled 257 and 3 quarters, down 1. March oats, the high 106 and 1/2, the low 105 and 1 quarter. It settled 105 and 1/2, down 3 quarters. May oats, the high 112 and 3 quarters, the low 111. It settled at 111, down 1 and 1 quarter. March soybeans, the high 476 and 1/2, the low 468. It settled at 468 and 1 quarter, down 8 and 1/2 for the day. May, the high 482 and 3 quarters, the low 474. It settled 474 and 1 quarter, down 8 and 3 quarters. July, the high 489 and 1/2, the low 480 and 1/2. It settled at 481, down 9. August soybeans, the high 487, the low 478 and 1/2. It settled 478 and 3 quarters, down 9. September, the high 484, the low 476. It settled 477 and 1/2, down 6 and 3 quarters. November, the high 488, the low 478 and 1/2. It settled 479 and 3 quarters, down 7 and 3 quarters. January, the high 491, the low 488 and 1/2. It settled at 488 and 1/2, down 8 for the day. March soybeans, the high 503 and 1/2, the low 497. It settled at 497, also down 8. March soybean meal, the high 177.90, the low 174. It settled 174.10, down 380. May soybean meal, the high 172.90, the low 179. Rather, the low was 169.50. It settled 169.70, down 310. March soybean oil, the high 14.84, the low 14.58. It settled 14.65, unchanged. May soybean oil, the high was 15.23, the low 14.96. It settled 15.03, down 1. The settlement prices are in from the Chicago Mercantile Exchange, and with those numbers, here's Celeste Quinn.
Lower day today across the Chicago Mercantile Exchange. Let's begin with feeder cattle, as usual. January feeder cattle, 88.05, the high 87.35, the low 87.40, the settlement, that down 75. March, 89 even, the high, the low 87.47.5, the settlement 87.72.5, that down 125. April, 88.60, the high 87.30, the low 87.52.5, the settlement, that down 127.5. February live cattle, 79.25, the high 70.70, the low 78.22.5, the settlement, that down 82.5. April live cattle, 79.57.5, the high 77.92.5, the low, the settlement 78.35, that down 100. June live cattle, 73.37.5, the high 72.22.5, the low, the settlement 72.60, that down 70. August, 73.22.5, the high, 72.20, the low, 72.52.5, the settlement, that down 62.5. February, lean hogs, 56.25, the high, 54.92.5, the low, the settlement, 55.20, that down 147.5. April, lean hogs, 59.05, the high, the low, 57.47.5, the settlement, 57.47.5, finishing down the limit, down 200. June lean hog, 64.25, the high, 62.85, the low, the settlement, 63.17.5, that down 162.5. July lean hog, 61.65, the high, 60.25, the low, 60.77.5, the settlement, that down 117.5. February pork belly, 68 even, the high, 66.40, the low, 67 even, the settlement, that down 145. March belly, 69 even, the high, 67.47.5, the low, the settlement, 67.50, that down 165. The Dow Jones Industrial Average up 89 points at 10,668. The NASDAQ up almost 68 points at 28.26.
This market report is made possible with support from Cargill and its businesses serving Illinois, Cargill Ag Horizons, Cargill Grain and Oilseeds Processing, and Illinois Cereal Mills, providing customer-focused solutions to producers and consumers in the agri-food chain.
The forecast for Illinois and Indiana meteorologist Scott Althoff says, in northern Illinois this afternoon, look for mostly sunny skies. Elsewhere, partly to mostly cloudy. Highs ranging from 32 in far northern Illinois to 45 in the far south. Tonight in the north and in central sections, partly cloudy. In the south, mostly cloudy. Lows ranging from 10 in far northwestern Illinois to 28 in the south. Tomorrow in northern Indiana, mostly cloudy with snow showers developing. Elsewhere in the north and in central sections, partly sunny. And in the south tomorrow, mostly sunny skies. Highs ranging from 24 in far northern Illinois to near 40 in the far south. In Champaign-Urbana this afternoon, mostly cloudy, the high 39, winds southwesterly at 8 to 16 miles per hour, shifting to northwesterly by evening. Tonight, partly cloudy, the low 21, winds northwesterly at 5 to 15 miles per hour. Tomorrow, partly sunny, breezy, and cool, the high near 30, winds northwesterly at 10 to 20 miles per hour and gusty. Tomorrow night, mostly clear and cold, the low 14. The outlook for Thursday, mostly sunny, the high 30. The extended outlook for Illinois and Indiana, Thursday mostly sunny, Friday increasing cloudiness with snow arriving north, snow or rain arriving central, and rain arriving south. Saturday cloudy with some snow north, snow and rain central, and rain south. Highs Thursday in the 20s north and in the 30s central.